This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscoen, sitting in for Terry Gross. The stock market is still reverberating after October 27th's 554-point plunge. There have been steep ups and downs in the last few weeks as investors attempt to take advantage of the market's volatility. Jane Bryant-Quinn says that if you're a smart investor, you should ignore these short-term fluctuations because in the long run, the market is a safe bet. Jane Bryant-Quinn is a syndicated columnist as well as the personal finance columnist for Newsweek magazine and for Good Housekeeping. She has just updated and revised her 1991 book, Making the Most of Your Money. The country's economy and financial picture is changing, buffeted in part by the global marketplace and by new tax codes just enacted by Congress. With all this going on, we invited Jane Bryant-Quinn to join us today to help us to make sense of some of these changes. We began with the stock market, and I asked her how she would describe what happened the last week of October. Was it a crash, a correction, a warning, or irrational exuberance?
Well, we certainly aren't going to call it a crash. I would be happy to call it a warning. You know, we've had nothing but good global news for about 10 years now. You know, lower inflation, lower deficits, freer trade, all kinds of good things have been happening. This is the first reminder that from time to time, bad things happen. And what is going to happen to the United States as a result of this is going to be somewhat slower growth because there are a lot of U.S. companies that do business in with the Asian countries that got in trouble, and Japan is going to hurt because the rest of Asia is hurting, and so a lot of businesses do business in Japan. So they're not going to do as much business. So their profits aren't going to be quite as good as anticipated, and that means that their stocks aren't worth as much. And how much less their stocks are worth is what the market has been trying to figure out. So this isn't just kind of stock market nutso. This is a real economic event that is going to take a little bit of growth off world commerce for a while.
And should we think then globally when we think about the stock market, and certainly there's much more global wheeling and dealing going on, but for the average investor, should they be knowing about what's happening in Southeast Asia or in Europe and thinking about how that might impact their own stocks?
Do you know, it's almost impossible, I think, for the average investor to keep a mind open all the time to all of these different parts of the world. I mean, whoever heard of the ringgit, you know, the Malaysian currency? Whoever heard of the baht, the Thai currency? And who wants to know when you have so many other things on your mind? I think that the way investors need to understand it is, first, obviously, we have a global economy that can affect ours. And as a long-term investor, and you should be only a long-term investor, no short-term money should be in the stock market. But as a long-term investor, you need to own some mutual funds that invest in stocks. I'm a mutual fund buyer and a big believer in them. You own U.S., big stocks, small stocks, and you own at least one broadly diversified international fund. And then as an investor, you let the manager of your mutual fund worry about the baht and the ringgit and Japan and Europe and all those other things, because you will have a participation in the long-term events in the rest of the world. And from time to time, it will go down, as it has in Southeast Asia. But most of the time, it will go up, as it does in the United States. We have recessions, but mostly we have growth. The same is true of the rest of the world. And if you are invested in it that way, you don't really have to think about it on a day-to-day basis.
But does it make sense to look at Europe and to look at European companies as a place to invest as opposed to Asia?
At the moment, I would say that from an economic point of view, the European situation is terrifically positive because I think of Europe as being more or less where the United States was in 1983, 1984, when it was just starting out on what was a very difficult course of downsizing, reengineering, reorganizing to try to get our U.S. companies more set for global competition and also internal U.S. competition. Well, the same process has been starting in Europe the past couple of years as they realize that they have a lot of sclerotic industries. They have to be more prepared for global competition. And also, as they get their common currency together, which is supposed to be coming in 1999, and there's a very good shot that it will, then they are also going to have more internal competition as our country does. So they are going through reengineering, downsizing. It's harder in their political environment, but they're doing it. And so let's, if what happens to Europe is what happened to the United States, then you're saying, you know, you have a very good long-term growth story, and that means you have a very good long-term investment story. So maybe the European markets can have the same kind of long bull run that the U.S. market had. As far as Southeast Asia is concerned, you know, those markets are in terrible shape. But, you know, when a market really goes down, I mean, they've had a crash in Southeast Asia. I'm a value investor. I'm interested in markets that go down. So if you have an international mutual fund and you say, okay, you know, I want my guy to be investing in Asia because those stocks are really cheap now. So if I'm going to hold for the long term, that's probably a good bet. And I certainly want to be invested in Europe because there's a long-term growth story there. And so this adds up to a broadly diversified international fund. You know, it's harder to say pick a spot, to pick a country, pick a section of the world. But if you just stay diversified, you've got it all.
Well, I wonder, too, when experts and advice columnists tell people to keep things, to hold on to stocks long term. For some people, that might be 3 weeks. For other people, that might be several generations. What's your definition of long term?
A perfect point. My definition of long term, where I will take the risk, is more than 4 years. Mm-hmm. And for many people, they'll be sort of stunned. They think that's a very long number. But if you look at all of the bear markets since World War II, I asked Ibbotson Associates in Chicago to do this data for me. If you look at the peak of the bull market, and then the market drops and drops and drops. It turns around. It comes back up. So it gets back to the point where it started, and you reinvest dividends. And I said, how long does it take for a market to recover? And on average, it takes 2 years. The worst market we've had has taken 3.5 years to recover. That was 1972-73 bear market. So if this is money you are absolutely going to need within 4 years, there is a chance that maybe you won't have it. So that's, I sort of draw a 4-year line and say, I'm going to keep my money safe if it's, I absolutely have to have it in 4 years. So if my daughter is 14, and she's going to college, that means I don't want her freshman year money in stocks because there's a risk that maybe the market will go down and won't come back. When she's 15, I don't want her sophomore year money in stocks. So, but if she's 2, I certainly want to have her college money invested in broadly diversified stock-owning mutual funds because there she's got a long time.
Well, I've certainly heard others tout this philosophy of long-term, but they're also best-selling books with another philosophy. And I wonder, too, with the micro-analysis of Wall Street, we get morning reports, we get hourly reports, we get daily reports, whether that really makes it difficult to think long-term because it's like constantly taking your temperature during the day and finding out how you're thinking, how you're feeling.
That's so true. And if I have any message at all, Marty, it is don't do that. This kind of daily looking at stocks, trying to guess, trying to bet, you know, that is long-term a loser's game. This is something the professionals play, and most of them don't beat the market. All of the academic research shows that it is incredibly rare for professional investors to beat the market long-term. And if it's rare for professionals to beat the market long-term, you know, what are you and I going to do when we're bidding against these professionals? And I know people who say, listen, I've owned, you know, these 12 or 15 stocks, and they're fabulous, and they've gone up, and they've beaten the market. And, well, maybe they have beaten the market, but they've beaten the market. The person who has done it has taken a very high risk, and he took a high risk, and he got a high return. But what happens when the market turns down? I'll tell you, I want to be a long-term investor, and I think that the way to do it is to own well-diversified mutual funds and hold on to them and not take the market temperature every day. I think that's the kind of thing that will lose you money rather than make you money over the long term.
Well, we're going to take a very short break, and then I want to talk some more. And our guest today is Jane Bryant-Quinn. She's personal finance columnist for Newsweek magazine, and she has just updated and revised her 1991 book. It's called Making the Most of Your Money. We'll be back after a very short break. This is Fresh Air. Jane Bryant-Quinn is my guest today on Fresh Air, and she's the personal finance columnist for Newsweek magazine, and she's just updated and revised her 1991 book. It's called Making the Most of Your Money. I'm thinking about the baby boomers who are now middle-aged, and many of them caught between trying to figure out how to pay for college for their children, how to figure out how to afford their retirement, which is coming probably in 10, 15, 20 years. Under those circumstances, is one more important than the other? Is retirement more important than educating your children?
Retirement is, and that's, I know, going to sound odd
to people.
Ouch, because we all love our children dearly, and our responsibility is to, help them advance and educate them. You have your children, you're responsible for giving them the best start in life. And so, but here is the, so ideally you would have tried to save money for both, but the plain fact is that a lot of people haven't been able to afford to save money for both. And if you cannot save for education and retirement, you have to save for retirement first. And the reason is that, when you retire, that's the only pot of money you're ever going to have. And you may live to 100, and that is it. And it's a very key, it's key to your personal survival. And your children, very often you find, first, there are wonderful state, colleges and universities that cost less than private schools. So there is a cheaper way to get a good education than going to a private school. And there are student loans that the students can take on and the students can pay back. They're 18, 19, 20, 21. They have a lifetime ahead of them in order to try to deal with these costs, whereas you are at the end of your working life and you don't have a lifetime ahead of you to earn more money and deal with these costs. So it's kind of a brutal triage.
Yeah,
but the fact is that is economically the only reasonable way to go. Because what if you spend your whole retirement pot of money on your children's education? Who's going to support you in retirement? Maybe your kids would just as soon you kept it, and then they don't have to support you.
Americans are notoriously bad savers. I don't know if we've done any better in the last couple of years or not. You suggest that everybody can set aside 10% of their income for savings. And I'm sure people listening to that are saying, yeah, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
my neighbor
right.
can, but I certainly can't. How do you suggest people, analyze, look at their spending, their income, and try to figure out the pennies that they can put together to find this 10%?
Let me tell you a personal story about this, Marty. Because when you lay out your budget, or as I like to call it, your spending plan, it doesn't sound so serious as a budget, and you try to find that kind of money, it is practically impossible to find. But here's what happened to me when I was much younger and I was a single mother. I had a son and the child support was not forthcoming. Life was not easy. Those days when the bills come in and you just don't open them because you can't pay them. One of the ways of dealing
sure.
with bill you can't pay is not open the
of
envelope.
Of course.
And so I'd been through all of that. And a colleague, I was working for a company, and a colleague said, are you saving any money in the company plan? And I said, are you out of your mind? I can't pay the dentist. And he said, why don't you just try taking 5% out of your paycheck automatically? He said, you'll find that you can do it and things won't change. And I was very skeptical, but I wasn't making all that much money, and 5% wasn't all that much anyway at that time. So I said, okay, I'll try it. And I had 5% deducted automatically and invested. And do you know what happened to my life?
No.
Nothing. Nothing happened. I was living exactly the same way. Life was just as tight. But all of a sudden, I was saving 5%. And I said, this is sort of amazing. I raised it to 7%. And nothing happened. I raised it to 10%. Nothing happened. I couldn't believe it. And I raised it to 12%. I noticed it. I cut it back to 10%. But the thing is that this kind of saving that comes out of your paycheck and you don't even see it picks up money that slips through your fingers that you don't even know where it's gone. And I'll tell you, I was living very low, and I was still able to do this because I would basically look at what was in the bank, and I would somehow, without having a budget even, I would somehow figure out how to live on what I had there. And I don't know how it works, I don't know why it works, but I know it is magical. And I have encouraged lots of people to do it, as I was encouraged to do it, and they have all said to me, it works.
Interesting. Well, I know that credit card debt rivals, I believe, the federal debt in trillions of dollars.
It's pretty awful, isn't it?
Well, you know, what do you suggest people do with their credit cards? And boy, it seems like every day you get another piece of mail saying, well, we'll give you a credit card and you can have so much money at your fingertips, or you turn on your television and there's that same kind of message. It's awfully tempting to use those easy credit cards because it does make it seem so easy.
That's right, and it makes the banks a lot of money. Yeah. And if you borrow too much, the banks could care less, because if you go bankrupt, that is your problem and not the bank's problem. And in fact, they're down in Congress trying to make it harder for you to go bankrupt,
right,
so that they can give you even more credit. I mean, it just really, it makes me very mad, because although certainly we are all responsible for our own credit, at the same time, the bankers have discovered that they can lend a lot of money to people who are basically not credit worthy, and enough of them will repay, so they profit even though a certain percentage of them go broke. And I think that is an incredibly cynical attitude, and I just hate to see the banks doing that.
Yeah, do you suggest that people have one or two credit cards and leave it at that, and that, of course, will keep some kind of control over that easy money?
You bet. I just think all those credit card things that come in the mail, you should do what I do with them. I don't even open them. I don't read the envelopes. I just pitch them out. You don't need a couple of credit cards are absolutely all you need. And if you have one credit card that has a low interest rate, so that's the credit card you would use if you were going to stretch out your purchases. And then you can have one credit card that doesn't matter what the interest rate is, but it has no annual fee. And then you use that card for purchases that you know you're going to pay off by the end of the month. You're in very good shape, and you're in good control of your spending. And then I would also encourage you not to increase your credit limits. It's right. Another way of imposing a discipline on yourself. I mean, an 18% credit card, you are voluntarily adding 18% to the cost of everything you buy. If you went into a store and they said, this costs this amount, but we're going to add 18%, would you buy it? No, you turn around and walk away. And then you put it on your credit card and you don't pay it off for a year or 2 years, and you're adding this money without even realizing it.
Well, how do you suggest people then pay down that credit card debt? And again, it can be daunting as some of those percentage points add up.
The worst thing you can do is pay the minimum on your credit card. Most credit cards are set up so that the debt you have right now on your credit card is designed to last for 30 years if you pay only the minimum. And if you add $5, $10, $15, $20, $25 to that a month, you can bring what was a 30-year debt down to maybe a 5-year debt. It is incredible how rapidly credit card debt can diminish when you start paying considerably, or paying even modestly more than the minimum. And the other thing, of course, is to just sort of, I guess, treat it like, that day-by-day sort of step program for, Alcoholics Anonymous and Spendaholics Anonymous and all this other thing. You just say, take it one day at a time and say, I am not going to go any further into debt today. If I want to buy something, I'm going to pay cash. I'm going to use a credit card. I'm going to use a debit card, which is the same as paying cash. I am not going to put down my credit card for something. And you get through one day, and then you say, okay, today I am not going to put down my credit card. And you try to control, if your spending is out of control, you try to control the use of your credit card that way.
Well, it sounds like a 12-step program to me that you're describing.
Well, it's like a 12-month program or something. See, I have a friend who said what she did was she took her credit cards and she froze them in the ice tray. And so they were there. But then she said that at Christmas, what she did was defrost them. So there's a risk there.
Well, of course, when you're trying to take care of all these bills and debts hanging over your head, it's so easy to feel like you're on a diet or you're deprived or, you know, somehow you're not able to participate in this great American dream.
I know, but you know, then you're not taking control of yourself. You're not taking charge of yourself. I mean, are you a victim or are you in charge? I mean, the whole message here is that you know what your income is, you know what your future needs are, you're an intelligent human being. You know, are you just going to sit back and let all of this drift over you as if you're some kind of a dummy? I mean, you don't need to do that. And most Americans, in fact, live in a state of being in charge of their money and their debt and their investments. And sure, we all charge more on our credit cards than we should from time to time. And then we look at the bills and we say, gee, I've charged too much. And then you say, I'm not going to buy things for a while until it's paid off. This is the way most Americans handle their money. Most Americans are, in fact, very responsible. And then the people who aren't doing it just sort of need to take a look at, are they just whining instead of paying attention to how to manage their lives?
Personal finance columnist Jane Bryant Quinn has just updated her 1991 book, Making the Most of Your Money. I'm Marty Moscoane, and this is Fresh Air.